Welcome to our Future Skies in partnership with AIG. I'm John Strickland. This is a podcast where we gaze into the crystal ball, we peer through the mist, and we look at what the future may hold for the airline business. The industry's never been one for those of a nervous disposition, whether we look at wars, geopolitical upheavals, economic crises, or even the cut and thrust of competition in the industry itself. There's always something to cause unexpected turbulence. And the greatest challenge of all, of course, today is that of sustainability. So with all this in mind, where might it be in 10 to 20 years from now? What factors and influences are going to shape its trajectory? We've already gained perspectives, insights and experience from a range of guests on the podcast, but the track record of today's guest is truly exceptional. So I'm very happy he's agreed to come on. He's always been forward-looking since working on the foundation of an airline which has become a true global leader. He's imagined the unimaginable, and he's been the architect of a company which many believed at its creation couldn't possibly work. That airline is Emirates. The man, president of the airline, Sir Tim Clark. So, welcome to our Future Skies, Tim.
Hello, John. I'm glad to be here.
Good to have you on board today, Tim. We normally have these kind of discussions on stage at conferences, but this is a first for you and I doing a podcast, so it's really good to have you as my guest. And although we're going to be looking to the future, I'd like to start, Tim, by looking over the past almost 40 years to Emirates as it is today, from what you could say were its humble beginnings back in 85 when it had just a couple of leased aircraft, today over 260 aircraft. What would you say your reflections over that period of time being, as I described you, the architect of this airline?
Well, I think as you said in your intro, it's been three, probably four decades of a very troubled planet when you look at everything that's changed. As a result of the geopolitics, the socioeconomic revolution we've been through, the digital age, the age of the various online platforms, social media, etc., these have been so transformative. But when I look back and I realize what we did and how we were able to accomplish what we did in the time that we did, a lot of these factors, surprisingly and perhaps paradoxically, come into play. As the world digitized and became far more linked, and we know the story there, you could equate the growth of demand for air travel almost linked to what happened in the mid-90s onwards. So in our formative years, in the first 10 years, we were busy building an airline based on what I thought was a business model that was fit for purpose defined by the trading conditions on the planet of the day. So if you look back at why we did what we did in the first 10 years, you can understand where we saw the opportunities, because the competition at that point in time was pretty mediocre. Certainly people like me saw an opportunity in improving things significantly. And this wasn't just about in-flight product. It was about the way business models were functioning post-war, and the legacy of that was still in place. We saw a number of carriers still in their ownership model of being state-owned and run by civil servants. So as we came through, we looked around us and saw what was happening and what we could do. We realized that there are a lot of things that we were very low-hanging fruit in terms of the business model. And you and I have talked about that for a long time. Mm-hmm. We started moving at pace, and the rest up until the arrival of the 777s in the mid-90s was steady, spectacular, I must say. Was it a huge capacity growth that we saw in the later years? Probably not, because we had much smaller aircraft, like the 310s and the 600Rs from Airbus, and the 727s and all the ragtag bobtail ones we had before then. But it wasn't until we got the 777s that our production really started to improve and our product range started to improve. But that coincided with what happened on the planet, and the digital age hit us, the age of information hit us. Wealth was being created at pace, which all came to a sad end in 2008, 2009. But if you look at the GDPs of the economies that we were serving, at that point in time, they were moving at pace. Remember Gordon Brown, "There will never be boom bust again, and this is onwards and upwards, the Chinese economy going at 16%. Everybody was in such a tearing hurry to take advantage of what was seemed to be an unstoppable demand for just about anything and everything. fueled by our naughty bankers who decided to fund all of this without any collateral whatsoever. So, you know, the paradox is that despite the sort of, it's not malfeasance, but the abuse of the opportunities that were given to us through the digital age, we were certainly able to exercise and grow. So when I look at those terms of trade that were favorable towards us, that also required us to be able to look at them, exercise the opportunity through the vision, the design, the adaptation of the business model to what was clearly happening. And as I said, the old legacy carriers known then were absolutely insistent that nothing would change. So the defining patterns of movement from places like Africa to the Far East was always over the European hubs. The Americans had no notion of sixth freedom. Even today, they don't understand the notion of hubs, international hubs, where you might fly into Atlanta from London and go on to Chile. But you still have to get off the airplane, have an American visa, go through, collect your bag and all that. And the notion that they would have airside transport, even today, is non-existent. So imagine what it was like 30, 40 years ago. And this defined a lot of the post-state-owned legacy carry business models. And a lot of that is still there today. You'll be surprised. I can name a few close to home in Europe. So for us, it was basically an open form architecture. In other words, how we had no restrictions apart from the aeropolitical ones. We had, as you know, no assistance financially from anybody, contrary to popular opinion. But we were able to move at a pace that allowed us to grow the fleet, allowed us to define what that fleet needed to be in the future, read the 330 program, the 340 program, latterly the 380 program, definitely the 7779 program, and to a large extent, the ER program, the 777, because our buying power bought us access to the top of the manufacturers, both propulsors and airframe. So with that, we were able to find what we wanted for our business model, and by and large, that's what we've got. So then it was, is this going to scale? Is this business model really scalable? The way I looked at it was that so scalable was it that with the tools that we defined and they were presenting us, we could reach just about every city on the planet. And by doing that on a high capacity basis, minimum one daily frequency, and offering a range of products at price points that people could afford, it opened up a new dimension of travel for us. And of course, the proof of the pudding was that so many others followed our lead, and they still do. So we know we got that right. I'm not really blowing our trumpet, but in the end, the redefinition of medium to long haul travel, I honestly believe, was defined by us. It was what the traveling public globally wanted. They wanted to do business. The huge numbers of SMEs coming to market, particularly in the technology field, the unbelievable growth in the leisure segments as wealth was created and people shed debt. The retirees, the baby boomers, but now we've got a lot of young kids who are fairly wealthy through their technology SMEs and all the other bits and pieces. And multiple segments have opened up within that leisure segment, if you could call it that. So it was a question of keeping our radar going 360 degrees, 360 all of the time, 24/7. Looking at the way things were changing on the planet, fashion, furniture design, interior design, automotive, hospitality. How are the changing tastes of the people that populate the planet moving at a pace? And you've never seen such a change. You can imagine post-war up until about the early 90s, everybody was still doing the same thing. Although the people of the 60s will say, no, it's a revolution, flower power, and rock music, et cetera, et cetera. But in fact, the tastes and what they did and why they did it were very channeled and conditioned. What happened, as I said earlier, was the digital revolution. And that just changed everything. So, you know, keeping an eye on what was going on, what is still going on going forward. We're looking all the time to see what is evolving. I mentioned the leisure segments. This is something else. And on top of that, of course, underpinning a lot of it was this government in Dubai, which was always on this mantra, this determination to build a global metropolis, the likes of which nobody's ever seen. That has also been emulated by countries around us. So they know they got that right as well. Imitation is the best form of flattery, if you can like, you can call it that. So this is when I kind of look forward and I look at what we've planned, what we bought into, what we are going to do, it's scaling more of the same.
No, it's a remarkable, Tim, as you said, you know, that vision moving from a couple of Airbus aircraft. I remember going on one of those A310s, my first trip on Emirates down to Dubai, and my first understanding of Dubai. You describe that kind of symbiosis between the country and the airline. The two in tandem have grown and continue to do so, and the scale that you've reached today in the context you describe is pretty awesome. But I was interested in what you said as well, although those changes have happened, it's remarkable when you reflect that, as you said, some airlines, as you said, close to where I am now, haven't changed their mentality. Still, you know, going down the same road, still the same, keeping the doors closed. It is really quite a remarkable set of circumstances against which you've grown. Now, I think you've just demonstrated in those comments as well, Tim, you know, that you're more than familiar with gazing into the crystal ball that I alluded to, confounding conventional wisdom or limiting beliefs of others. So let's turn to some of those themes of the future and explore them a little deeper and see what that means for Emirates in the industry. I mean, first of all, the structure of demand, you've already described changes that have taken place and are taking place there. We've gone through the pandemic. That showed us changes again. In many ways, if there was any kind of rule book, it had to be thrown out. We saw a different structure of demand as it came back. Leisure travel is growing strongly. Premium leisure, business travel is not quite what it was. How do you think that shape of demand is going to pan out? You were very optimistic. I remember talking to you during the pandemic, far more than I was. I must admit, I thought it was the end in many respects. You were saying that's not the case, and you've been proved right.
Yeah, I on that particular point, I mean, you and I go back a long time in this business. I've seen so many global upheavals. I've seen so many regional upheavals, etc. And, you know, the airline business, for all the reasons I mentioned earlier, not just about Emirates, has become hugely efficient, hugely resilient. And it's this resilience which can deal with these global knocks, whatever they may be. Admittedly, the pandemic was probably the worst since the Second World War in terms of the effect it had. But you notice, and where I always believed, even in the middle of 2020, when we were, as an airline, grounded, so was the whole industry, borders were closed, I would not believe and I would not accept that this was going to be a paradigm change to the way we go about our business. I watched what had happened in the past, how bounce back came so quickly, so voluminously. Wasn't as sustained as this one has been, but nevertheless, there was always a pattern and a trend. And so, you know, we were able to be one of the first movers internationally on that and get to grips with it. So when you look at, you know, the way we are today and what we're likely to be in the future, what we have to deal with, nothing really changes, John. We've got a war in Gaza. We've got a war. Bab al-Mandab is blocked. The Suez was blocked in 1956. I used to go on ships around the Cape when I was a kid. You know, I look as the way the history repeats itself. We've got a war in Ukraine. We've got a sort of global geopolitics, which are looking a little bit flaky at the moment, fairly threatening and intimidatory. It doesn't look good out there when you look at the potential threats coming down the line. You've got a weakened China. I don't think that's going to last long, by the way. You see a shift in the alignments of countries. So even the UAE has joined BRICS. And so you've got this sort of formation of trading blocs, which are starting to morph. And of course, this has a big effect on global demand. You know, the notion that you were to onshore closer to home, or being manufacturing closer to home to the European markets, because COVID taught them certain things, the supply chain complexities that have, and the difficulties of the supply chain meeting the just-in-time inventory requirements of automotive in Germany, the UK, etc. This was, if there was a paradigm shift, it was COVID forced countries to think about that quite seriously, even though they may be having to face more expensive production platforms or production zones, because they needed these things just in time. Equally, they didn't want to be held hostage to vaccine production or whatever. So more and more of that is being looked at with a more, I'm not saying nationalistic look, but nobody wants to get short and be exposed to what had happened in the 30 years prior to COVID, where there was a shift in production platforms, production zones from the West to the East, as I mean, know the story there. Now then, going forward, how does that affect the way business morphs internationally, zonally, both above wing and below wing, cargo and passengers as well? But you know, I'm not going to predict what is likely to happen there. All I am saying, I sense change coming, and I sense that the change will bring opportunity. Sorry, we're fairly predatorial. We'll look at anything that brings us benefit. We'll move quickly to get onto it. And will that change necessarily be a bad thing? Well, only time will tell. But we have a pretty good track record as mankind of turning adversity into advantage and learning from that and being better fit people than we were prior to the event, if you can call it that. So when I look forward and I see the number of people getting on our aeroplanes today, I see no deviation, no change. Everybody told me that business would disappear. Business is below level. Now, how do you measure business travel? What is business travel today? You know, I've always said that the business class cabins are a misnomer because they've been populated by people who have the money to meet the price point demands that we have for the premium seats. Surprisingly, that covers a huge variety of people. As soon as the business element starts to go south, it rapidly gets backfilled with people who want the seats and haven't been able to get them because the demand has been so strong. So for me, this is not a sort of short-term issue. What is an issue is that, you know, is business going south because economies are going south? Okay. Is this a global phenomenon? Is this a shift down towards GDP across the planet of going down to less than one, they're going into recession, et cetera, et cetera? You know, if the war in Gaza stopped, if the war in Ukraine stopped, and if people backed away from threatening, intimidatory behavior, then the planet would rock, go into a pace of growth the likes of which you've never seen. Investment would start moving big time. People would start traveling even more than they are. And believe me, John, we have real problems trying to meet the demand for the 259 passenger aircraft we got flying today. And that includes the 380s. And I know that given a chance and given these economies allowed to move without being subjected to intimidation, fear, or whatever it may be, things would really move ahead at pace. So, you know, I'm optimistic that that will happen even at times like this, when it is not the, let's say, in terms of decision making with regard to buying houses, buying cars, white goods, travel, it's not an easy decision to make, you would think. But one of the easiest decisions, despite all of this, is people want to get on planes and go on holiday and look at the rest of the world. After all, they were banged up for 3 years. Look at the New Zealanders, look at the Victorians in Australia, etc. They never want to get caught like that again. They are definitely going to fill their experience coffers with looking at the world, doing all the things that they wanted to do now, not later, in case the same thing happens, or there is some global phenomenon. That may be part of the reason that we've seen a sustained, it's not just Emirates, by the way. Etihad's had it, Qatar's had it, British Airways has been very strong. But the airline industry has, you know, it's not without some areas being weaker than others. So going forward, what do I see out here? Well, you know, our plans are fairly well defined now for the next 16 years. And we are assuming that we will continue to be as successful as we've always been. We will continue to refresh, revitalize, and renew our customer-facing products in the customer experience platform. We will continue to shock and stun people with what we're doing, and we will continue to be a kind of gold standard. And so long as there's a lot of noise about what we're doing, then I will sleep easy in my bed. It's when I there is silence. I know that I need to start worrying. I say I, we, because I won't be around all that long for this period of time going forward. But I remain optimistic. If we can get through COVID and the airline industry can come, as I said it would at the time, airline industry can come out smelling of roses, starting to make net margins before tax of, you know, 9 or 10%, unheard of in our business, generally running along about 2 if you're lucky, then we can get through anything. So do I see that this is some global trauma? I think it's a good story going forward.
No, it's very reassuring in many ways to hear that, Tim, and it makes a lot of sense. I think what you said about people's desire to travel, if we think about just continuity of the human race, if we get these politicians to back off a bit from the posturing that we're seeing, certainly all the young people that I speak to, and doubtless you speak to, they all want to travel like mad. People of many nationalities, you know, the digital age has made them aware much more of a world they're in than perhaps previous generations could be. And aviation is a means to fulfill it. You mentioned also about China. You don't share the view that China will remain in the doldrums. Do you think there could be a shift in the balance with perhaps you could say tired old Europe, tired old USA, and that China, Asia, indeed, ultimately, the sleeping continent of Africa, places like that are going to become more the drivers of future growth?
Well, it's a good question, John. I don't want to be disingenuous to the Europeans, but I sense there is a, using that old axiom, the sleep at the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
The European economy is tanking at the moment. They have enormous internal stresses within the project itself, and trying to keep this all together as one harmonious unit too. And this whole business about, because of these things, they are very much inward looking, and they tend to deal with the problems of the moment. I mean, we got Hungary at one point and whatever it may be with regard to the work of the ECB and all those kind of things. But they seem to be ignoring or not doing as much as they could do, apart from lip service, to the markets as they're changing overseas. So when I mentioned the realignment of the BRICS countries, mm-hmm. and more, these were originally 5 countries. Now there's a lot more in that, and they're aligning themselves to deal with those demands of those markets, the production bases in those markets. And if they're not careful, the Europeans and the Brits have been trying so hard to get out of that mold, but as long as you've got the politics in the UK as it is today, not a lot is going to happen. A great country, enormous potential, untapped, but being marginalized to extent or held back by the political situation over there. This is not good for anybody. When I look at the go-ahead countries, and you mentioned some of them, but I mean, Africa is a continent of contrasts, and how it's going to pull itself out of that is more difficult for anybody to say. But certainly in the Eastern theater, that's why I talk about China and other parts of Asia, Vietnam, Indonesia, Thailand, their economies will probably strengthen. And so long as there's a degree of cohesion, economic cohesion amongst them, and also you can rope in Africa at some point and South America, then they've got a fighting chance of shifting the balance. And when you shift the balance of economic power, shift of political power takes place, whether you like it or not. And so the Europeans need to be very careful that despite the wonderful nature of the 28 or 27 states all pulling together, they need to be very much aware of what is going on out there and see how they can attune themselves to that rather than being so inward looking and so ghastly and beastly to each other. When somebody breaks the rules or doesn't agree with something, and now we've got, I think the other day was, the European Parliament is suing the Commission because the Commission gave Hungary access to the money that had been frozen in its budget. Can you believe that? The parliamentarians suing the Commission. I mean, it's just barking mad. Mm-hmm. But you see, as this goes on, all around them, things are changing. Now, goodness knows what's going to happen if President Trump goes back to be president again. this is going to be another paradigm change into the global geopolitic, if you like. Now, where are we in all of this in the airline? It's through this all, people will want to travel. And as things become even more uncertain, they want to travel more, just in case. You know, and getting back to technology and the effect this has had, you know, I go back to Bill Gates and COVID, and the days of business travel are over, and Zoom and Teams are going to be the just as we are today, this is the way forward. And I said, well, he would say that because of the Microsoft involvement. But what he seemed to forget, and when faced with the age of information, everybody says, if you remember the old days, video conferencing, nobody will ever do business again, nobody will travel. And that as we went into the digital age and more businesses were connected, the multiplier effect of the digital age on the global economy was unmeasurable and still is today. So the opportunities it created and the demands on the many, many companies that came to market because of the digital age caused them to jump on airplanes, to go to new markets, to new production zones, etc., to a level that we've never seen before on the planet. We were very channeled, you know? And so as we improve technology, and this works its way through in a good way to the global economy, so people paradoxically are actually not going to sit in front of things like we're doing at the moment. They'll do that and they'll do a lot more, because for the first time, it could be you and me meeting. You say, well, listen, let's go and have a chat somewhere where we're next, mm-hmm. and let's flesh this one out, etc. I get to know you. I get to see how it all works, etc., etc. So I can see all that. I remain optimistic about way the technology will reshape the way we do things from A to Z in the global economy. And that's going to give us an awful lot of great advantage. The notion that you've got AI coming down the track at such pace now that I've often said the three-day week is coming for everybody, and that the amount of leisure time and wealth created as a result of technology doing the providing, my big caveat, is that the few do not sort it out for the few, as we saw in the banking world in the age of information. You know, it was meant to be a universally good thing, mm-hmm. but some people hijacked the whole thing and lined their pockets. And we know what happened after that. The way technology is moving now, we have got a perfect opportunity of making sure that the distribution of wealth as a result of the wealth created through the technology that we're now embracing is shared fairly and evenly and not hogged by a few for the few. I'm pretty hot on that because I've seen how it went wrong and how it wrecked the global economy back in the first decade of this millennium. So if we assume that there is a fair wealth distribution, including the developing world, Africa, South America, whatever, and that people have more time on their hands and more money in their pockets, it could be that demand for air travel goes off the clock again. Now you will introduce, no doubt, the sustainability arguments in all of this. So I'm looking forward the next 10 or 15 years. We have mapped our plans to tail numbers by month until 2036, 37, 38, subject to Boeing and Airbus, of course. And we've mapped our network. We've mapped the destinations with it. We know where we're going to go. And this is a fairly aggressive expansion. So I call the third epoch of Emirates, the third era.
Well, I was going to say, Tim, I mean, you know, just to add to what you just reflected on there, all these opportunities for the future, technology you see in a positive way, you're not worried that AI is going to supplant the human species, as it were. If it's done in the right way, it can be our servant, not our master. And if we manage the income side of it properly, it does generate more air travel. And just to jump in on what you were saying there, I mean, you've already indicated you see Emirates comfortably doubling in size in the coming decades. We're going to move on in a little while to the subject dear to our heart of aircraft, but just the principle of doubling in size is certainly supported by what you're saying. There is this enormous opportunity coming down in the next few decades.
Absolutely. But I look at this city. When I came here with 600,000 people, it's now 6 million. Can I see that going to 15 or 20 in the next 10 or 15 years easily? So when you look at just Dubai alone, to get to and from Dubai is only possible by air, unless you want to come by road, which takes forever. And you look at the demand for passenger segments, the air travel demand out of here alone. On average, per capita, we get probably 6 or 10 rotations a year, okay, just out of Dubai. So 6 million people going 6 or 10 times a year gives you an enormous, enormous domestic base because they are upwardly mobile. So many businesses are based here. We've probably upset the Saudis, but
so many nationalities as well.
So many nationalities, absolutely. And as you know, Dubai has no restrictions, unless they're, you know, difficult countries, has no restrictions on who comes and lives and works here. So it's a truly multicultural, multinational country, city, that gives us great opportunities because of all the things that you said. So if you get more Sri Lankans, more Americans, more Brazilians, more Chinese, and they all are coming here because the advantages of living and working in Dubai are now quite apparent when it's becoming fairly restricted in other parts of the world. More and more people are coming here. So that's one thing that's going to underpin what we intend to do.
And I think it's something, Tim, that a lot of people miss. You know, people talk about Dubai and whether it's sustainable, whether Emirates is a true commercial business. People have missed that growth in Dubai. I mean, you described airlines who didn't even think about the true concept of hubbing, and hubbing was what gave you your early growth, people making connections through Dubai. But just that sheer figure you said, 6 million people in Dubai now, that level of travel, it's a massive local market in its own right, and it's multifaceted. Business, leisure, you name it.
Now don't forget, we have 20 million tourists going to 30 million. The cruise industry was, at one point, we had 14 ships based here, home ported, as they call it in the jargon, between October and April. The ship sizes here now, we've got the TUI group, the Mein Schiff, and all the other bits and pieces. These are 6,500 berth vessels that come into Dubai and stay here, and they go round and round and round every Saturday. And each time they change over, people get on, people get off. 6,500 people on, 6,500 people off. Multiply that by 14 ships, not quite that berth number, and then do that on a Saturday and a Sunday. You realize why we are completely clogged over the weekend. And then look at all the crew change, the victualling of those ships, bunkering, food, water, blah, blah, blah. It's a huge industry. We never had that, and we've attracted it here. We have 154,000 hotel rooms in Dubai, which beats most cities in the world today. And so the whole infrastructure, the bed to inventory, as far as the aviation sector to the hotel beds, all the other things grew under a well-organized plan, surprisingly. But as they built more and more hotels, whatever it may be, they built power. As they built power, they built desalination. As they built desalination, they built huge sewage collection and processing points. As they built that, they built schools. As they built that, they built hospitals. It wasn't any part of the economy that wasn't moving at the pace of the fastest growth element, which I think probably was us. And then everybody was moving at our pace. But the government ensured that nothing was left behind. And with that came the opportunities for what I call the invisible businesses, internet, media, technology, and all the other bits and pieces. Very fertile place because you had a human resource from all parts of the world. So you could really be selective in terms of
and tap into the best talent.
Of course you could. It's particularly in the technology fields. You weren't restricted to a Brit or a German or a French by reasons of whatever. No, you can all come here. And, you know, they've been hugely welcoming and removing all the restrictions for work visas. When they look at brain power, you can come in and you can spend 10 years here and we'll extract the value for the work that you do in those particular areas.
I mean, I look at Dubai, Tim, over these same decades that you've described. And when you describe, in some ways, the malaise of perhaps parts of the world like Europe, I don't understand why there are not more countries that have looked at Dubai and think, well, let's do the same in any part of the world. That multi-stranded approach, it's a visionary approach, but it makes so much sense. It's an economically sensible thing to do. It's a culturally, it's societal sensible thing to do. Yet I can't think of anywhere that comes close. There are other pretenders and other legitimate countries now trying to move ahead. You touched on Saudi, but I don't see anywhere that's really in that position of continuous improvement and development that Dubai is.
Well, I think that's fair comment, and I look at those countries that have done this, and I look at the champions who have led them: Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore, Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum in Dubai, and there's a few others out there. It's all about the people doing the right thing by the people. Now, if you looked at, say, the United Kingdom, you do not think that the United Kingdom has got everything going for it in terms of the span of its economic segments within the GDP? Of course it does, but everybody spends all their time bickering. The whole thing is dragged down and slowed down, because if there's a really good thing out there, the notion that you would do anything else but support it doesn't make any sense. But of course, people have to take political views and political stands because of that. The result is that it slows the economy, it slows the opportunity, it slows the competitiveness. So what you look around and you see those countries that have moved at pace, they've simply got on with the job. They have a buy-in from the workforce, both indigenous, in this case expat. Everybody wants to get the job done. They work hammer and tong to get it done because they can see the results. It's not as if they're all working absolutely flat out and nothing is manifesting itself. On the contrary, it can be seen, and people are saying, just as you have done about Dubai, how could this happen? How can they make this work? Because the government has a single-minded vision about what it needs to do and how it's going to do it. It's absolutely focused. There is no bickering at a political level. There is no this, no that. They just get on with the job. And because it's been so successful, the workforce, both expat and national, is 100% behind them. They want it to work. They're making it work. After all, when I came here, it was small Dubai, clustered around the creek, lots of sand, lots of beaches, and the odd hotel, nothing much there. It took a man to say, enough's enough of this. I'm going to do something completely different, which is what he did. He's the current ruler of Dubai. And everybody came behind him, everybody. And more companies realized that the ability to make the returns that they wanted in the early days very quickly, both in short and medium and long-term investment, was a good thing here, because despite all the geopolitical upheavals in the region, the first Gulf War, the second Gulf War, the various bits and pieces going around us, Dubai, and we had its difficulties in 2008, 2009, but then so did the rest of the world. It gets out of that, paces its way, and goes like a locomotive at 100 miles an hour, which is what it's doing. But it's not reckless. It's not done with gay abandon. It's done with precision and very careful planning. Sometimes they're a victim of their own success, our traffic problems and things like that, which, whereas, if you get a big traffic problem in the UK on the M25, like they close those junctions, whatever, for 2 or 3 days, the traffic problems in Dubai are met with, we will build 6 more junctions. We will build 6 more flyovers on those junctions. We will expand the roads by this, and we'll do it in 18 months. Now, I've been up and down on the M25, the M40, and the A34 to see roadworks that have been in trade for 2 years. And half the time, we don't see anybody working on them. Here they work 24/7. Okay, and this isn't about exploitation of labor and all the other things, because that narrative has long since gone. So they get the job done, they throw everything at it, they do it in great speed. Some of the road infrastructure in Dubai is the best in the world, and they are able to do this within the monetization model that they've created here. Remember, it's only now that they have corporate taxation coming into play. There is no income tax here. So the taxation streams to feed the infrastructure, the hospitals, the schools, have got to come from other sources. They've managed that. You don't see that in many countries in the world, John, which is why it's so fertile and so potentially strong for the growth of the airline over the next 15 or 20 years.
And do you think other countries, we touched briefly on Saudi, we look at aircraft orders, thinking specifically on aviation, we have massive aircraft orders and big economy ambitions in Saudi Arabia, getting to 100 million tourist visitors, diversifying the economy by 2030. We have similarly large orders from India and other countries. Do you think those countries can do it in parallel and the same degree of success?
Well, look, I don't want to throw bricks at anybody. I think if the Saudi government wishes to spend $1.5 trillion on taking itself from the 50s think to the 21st century and on steroids, then good for Saudi. Their domestic demand will rocket, their international demand will rocket. If he's going to bring 100 million visitors in, goodness me, he's going to need Tony Douglas on steroids, isn't he? And the air travel demands out of that kingdom in the formative years, as you can call it, then sustaining all of that beyond that is going to be enormous. So, you know, it's an opportunity for everybody what they're doing in Saudi. I mean, some of their methods are a little bit odd, but never mind. That's the way they want to do it. So, do I see that as something that adds to my views that the epicenter of the planet today, from an economic point of view, has got to be what's going on in the Middle East at the moment, notwithstanding the Israeli situation and the others. What is going on here, not just in Saudi, but also in the UAE and other countries? After all, they've had the benefit, quite a lot of oil income, given the prices of oil in the last few years. They're spending this at pace, and it is attracting an awful lot of foreign business, where I say Europeans need to be less asleep at the wheel, going and grabbing a lot of it as best they can, because if they don't, lots of others who want it and can do it. So I think, you know, demand for air travel will be strong into the kingdom while they build the kingdom. You know the projects. They are colossal. If you look at other points of what's going on, I've mentioned Dubai, I've done that. Abu Dhabi is also moving at pace. Etihad is regrowing itself. It's making money and it's filling its airplanes. So, you know, it all looks pretty good down here. And frankly, unless it's a geopolitical upheaval, I think there's going to be plenty more headroom out there as we go forward.
Tim, in the time we have left, one topic we haven't touched on yet, and I'm very aware some of the audience today may not even be from the airline industry, but aircraft, and as you mentioned earlier, sustainability, aircraft types are changing. There are many new types available now. Your fleet is going to change in the next 10 to 20 years quite significantly, particularly as the very large Airbus A380 ultimately bows out sometime during the 2030s. You've talked about that a lot before, the challenge that will come with capacity shortages at airports as economic growth, as we've described, continues. We won't have these large aircraft. Your fleet renewal is bringing in very advanced technology aircraft, but typically much smaller size. What does that mean for the change in your business model? I'm assuming it does mean a change in business model, more frequency, perhaps less large chunks of volume, because you don't have a choice. There is no son of Airbus A380 coming down the tracks.
No, but therein lies the problem. It's all very well to say we'll meet the capacity reduction by unit size by the 777-9, whatever that may be. But the notion that we will replace it with frequency, exactly where are you talking about? London?
How do you get in there?
Frankfurt? Paris? New York? Narita? Los Angeles? None of these are doing anything about increasing the capacity. Heathrow, second, third runway? There you go. So the way we are doing it is that hopefully we're very advanced now in our planning for the new airfield, and the network will expand significantly once we get that. So when you look to take you where you are in the United Kingdom, obviously when we're eventually shut out of Heathrow because we can't do any more, and believe me, it's almost impossible today. What's it going to be like in 10 years' time? I don't know. But the activation of the regional points, we're good at doing that. We've done it in all the European countries that we've been allowed to do it. We would do it a lot more in France if they allowed us to do it. But that has got to be the way. We will take the airline to the markets that ordinarily would go over a central hub. And dealing with the lack of a 380 when we should have been going the other way, is redesigning the 380 to be 25% more fuel efficient than the current one. And that can be done. That can be done. But everybody is too busy dealing with sustainability, hydrogen, other forms of power, and ignoring, apart from the single aisle, what they should be doing. You talked about, you know, just now about a variety of tools in the box. Well, there really aren't any. I've got 777, 737, 320, 350, 787, 779. That's it. Over and done with. No quads anymore. No high-end stuff. No 747-8i. No 380, et cetera, et cetera. What you see is what you get. And do I see a change in that going forward? Unfortunately, no, I don't. And this is a real irritant for me when I say to Guillaume Faury, who's running Airbus, Guillaume, this isn't all about 320s and 350s. After all, your 350-1000, which is the biggest one in your stable, has got an engine issue, okay, which Rolls are desperately trying to sort out, because Guillaume knows what you see is what you get. I said, Guillaume, no, you've got to come out and redo the 350. You need to cross over all the technologies in aerodynamics, in propulsion, in systems, in materials, and produce an even better aircraft that transitions us eventually to where we can say, if you believe it, that hydrogen is going to drive the aircraft of the future or whatever. But you'll be interested to know that at tops of industry, at the top of industries, there is such polarity in the adoption, adaption, and acceptance of hydrogen, both at a scientific level and at a commercial level, that I wonder where this is going to take us.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, when this debate is going on and we're busy trying to stuff our aircraft full of cooking oils and whatever it was, and all the baggage that brings us in terms of the pros and cons of the argument, we've ignored the fact that we can actually produce better, more fuel-efficient aircraft, less environmentally damaging, both in the upstream production of them as well as the operation of them. But that's been ignored now, as they spend billions on hydrogen or whatever. And on the other side of the Atlantic, well, Boeing is in such a pickle at the moment. The notion that it was not designing new airplanes, but is having great difficulty with the one that it's got, is also not a start. So when I look at the place I am in at the moment, and I don't mean a geographical place, but as a head of a business that is very forward thinking, adapts and adopts anything that comes up which will improve what we do. What I'm looking at is 380 going. It is the most popular aircraft on our network. It is the most profitable aircraft on our network. Paradoxically, it is one of the most fuel efficient aircraft, because I fly 617 seats into Manchester and it goes absolutely packed. So when you look at that and you compare that to 2.5 787-9s doing the same job, same number of people, she's 4% more fuel efficient by seat kilometer or by seat, whichever way you. So already we've got a very fuel efficient aircraft. But the paradox is that the demand today on our trunk operations is so strong. The 617 seater goes to 346. That's what the 777-9 is going to do for us. Hello, where do you go with this? Where do the airport authorities like Heathrow and Manchester and Frankfurt, who rely on people like Emirates coming in with these huge numbers of people, go to Birmingham Airport, they call our two class 380, 617 seats, they call the flight, and the whole departure lounge gets up and empties. And they've been busy eating, drinking, buying, whatever it is. We know that the income streams for airports is generally between 60 and 70% from the commercial side of the licensing, fast food, merchandising, etc. And the balance comes from aeronautical fees. The real money is in that. Now, when you take the capacity down of the average unit size serving those airports, things start going a little bit wonky in their funding model. If they don't have the funding model, they can't invest, or they won't invest. And there'll be too many PE players who want to extract value and get out rather than putting money into what needs to be done with these airports. The point I'm saying here is that as I look forward, the biggest single impediment to growth is the lack of vision or the lack of willingness of the main hubs to do what they should be doing, not cosmetic change in the front of a terminal, adding new toilets or increasing central search, you know, size of this. This is all diddly squat. It's minimal investment to try and relieve the pinch points. What they don't know is that demand continues to grow at between 4% and 6% per annum, depending which part of the world. On top of already congested airports, on top of Max Slot Airport. Where do you go with this, John? Where do you go?
Well, I hope these messages are going to land, Tim, with, as you say, people like the leaders of the manufacturers and indeed leaders of airports, politicians, all of them, because it's coming down the track pretty quick. And you may not be in the driving seat at that point, but your successor will be. And peer group will have to deal with those things. Just in the remaining time we have left, Tim, I think it's worth commenting that given the kind of the landscape you described there with the manufacturers, we don't have new aircraft projects coming in the way we've probably you and I have seen over the decades. There's been a flow of new technology of aircraft coming through. And linking that technology point to sustainability, you described all the investment and focus on things like sustainable aviation fuels. But do you have any hope? We talk about, there won't be different long-haul airliners, even in 50 years' time. They'll still be flying on, if not kerosene, it'll be SAF. That's the only solution. You're investing as an airline in a technology fund, $200 million currently, to try to get work done. We know there are things happening for electric aircraft, hydrogen aircraft, short haul, regional, but do you have any sense of optimism and vision there that we'll break through this and we will find ways to bring long haul technology up to get away from this challenge?
I don't want to be a real pessimist on this, but I can't see it happening this century in the long haul, medium long haul market. I think we've got to accept and we must provide for the inevitable situation that there will be no capability of alternative fuels to do the kind of missions that we're doing today. And those kind of missions are growing at pace. These are the ultra long haul missions. So you see the 7879, 7878. These are flying for 16, 18, and Project Sunrise goes ahead with Qantas, 21 hours of flying. More and more of that is coming. So the ability to apply a alternative fuel, and I say alternative, whatever it may be, I can't see anything breaching the simple physics of the fossil fuel power calorific value that it gives us today. I know that's difficult to say. I think there will be enormous amounts of work. People are desperately trying to get to a situation where they can, one, understand how this is done, and two, how they're going to scale it. If you are going to scale the electrolysis part of hydrogen extraction, then you need inordinate amounts of power, which cannot come from sustainable sources, because the sustainable power is driving your power and utilities, everything else. So there just isn't enough power to go around until you embrace nuclear. But nuclear goes from hot to cold, sorry, it's the wrong words, but hot and cold in the political spectrum. 1 minute it's the flavor of the month, next minute it's been thrown out. Read the Germans. Coal, nuclear, now we're going to do it all with wind. Really, you're going to power the Ruhr on cooking oil and wind? And a bit of solar, if you're lucky. I don't think so. So is the global economy, and of course, you know, they've got so many differences of opinion, partly driven by politics, don't forget, and different thinks on all of this. I wonder where this is all going to take us. If, as I've always said, if we could fly today with 100% cooking oil, extraction, garbage, whatever, the airline community would take every single ounce of it without exception. They're as much concerned about the environment as the next man. But we have a job to do. And if, as long as there is no alternative, we must do this. We will continue. You mentioned the $200 million fund. We are looking at a number of things where we believe in academia. And those are the great universities of the United Kingdom, the Ivy League, etc., trying to find people who are working on potential breakthroughs in this incredibly hard nut to crack. And we will support those. That fund, by the way, is not just about sustainability. It's about, you know, being the good guy, looking after wildlife, as you know, I'm fairly keen on trying to put more into that, looking after communities to make sure they've got water and all the other bits and pieces. But by and large, I think The planet has done amazing things, John, since 206, amazing things in terms of reducing our footprint. It's just that global demand increases, the global population increases. As we become wealthier, we want more for all the right reasons. But if you took an inventory, and I often say this, go back to 2000, 2006, extrapolate fossil fuel usage in the absence of anything that happened since then, in terms of sustainability, awareness, etc., you would probably find yourself at least 50% above where we are today in terms of the usage of our fuels on the control based on a global population of X amount. We've done absolute wonders. And most importantly, probably for me, is an awareness of the man and woman in the street about what their conscience tells them about the environment. That never existed before, John. So much so that it's become a big political football, and people are starting to push it back. Read the Brits, read the Europeans. Actually, this is not going to get us elected if we put these onerous things on. But you know something? Everybody's aware of why they're there. It becomes a political football because it makes life more difficult for people living today because they've got to make all these adjustments and accept some punitive actions. But in the end, sustainability in the aviation field, very, very hard nut to crack. I honestly believe people have got their minds around that, except the extreme fringes of the argument. But I still think that the way we go about a business today, whether it be the footprint of supporting the airport activities, all the new structures we're going to build in the new airport will be zero carbon footprint if we can get away. We will use every trick in the book to ensure that we are decarbonizing at the pace that we can. But so long as our lovely jet engines cannot be run on electricity, flying an airplane with 575 all up weight tons from Dubai to Los Angeles on a battery, I think not. Sorry. So I've often argued we should, I'm not saying being carved out, but we should be given a certain amount of leeway. We talk about 2050 net carbon, net zero, and whatever it may be. There are now challenges out on that as to whether we're going to be able to achieve it. But we can do what we can do. We'll work flat out to do it. Whether or not we get there, anybody's guess.
Tim, maybe a good moment to draw a conversation to a close. I could continue, and we can
Yeah.
do another podcast. But as ever, a lot of optimism, realism, excitement about the future in what you've described, Tim. I've mentioned you always have a future-looking approach. Sometime you'll take your foot off the gas, and it will be over to your successor to take up the baton on that. But your legacy, I think it's fair to say, is already enormous, and so too is going to be your impact on the future. So, Sir Tim Clark, President of Emirates, many thanks for your time.
Okay, John, thank you.
Thanks to you for listening, and I hope we've offered you some valuable and visionary insights into our future skies viewed through Sir Tim's eyes. I'll be back soon with our next Our Future Skies episode in partnership with AIG. But for now, for me, John Strickland, it's goodbye.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast series are those of the speakers and do not reflect the views, policy, or position of American International Group, Inc., or its subsidiaries or affiliates, AIG. Any content provided by the speakers in this podcast series is their opinion and is not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, individual, or group of individuals, or anyone or anything. AIG makes no warranty or representations as to the accuracy, completeness, correctness, or validity of any information provided during this podcast series, and AIG will not be liable for any errors, inaccuracies, or omissions in the information provided during this podcast series, or any damages, losses, liabilities, injuries resulting from or arising from the podcast, including your use of the podcast.